I had a peculiar experience yesterday. I went to a memorial service, and instead of officiating over the service, I was down in the pews. At first, I felt a little uncomfortable. I'm supposed to be up there, not down here. I watched and I listened as my friend and colleague, Reverend Lee Ellen Strawn, the chaplain of Northfield Mount Hermon, presided over the service. I recognized what it was like to be her in that moment, intensely aware of being in front of a crowd of people who are in mourning, profoundly aware of the seriousness of the moment, treading carefully lest even the slightest misstep cause concern among those who were bruised and in pain when they arrived. The carefully crafted script, the thoughtful choreography, the rhythm of words, and the judicious use of silence. As someone who has presided over many memorial services, I am intimately familiar with all of this. Reverend Strawn did a lovely job. She was calm. She was serious. She conducted herself with grace and poise. When it is your job to make sure that the ritual of remembrance is performed well, you must keep your wits about you. You can be sad, but you have to be the steady person in the room, the one who steers the ship back to calm waters. And it was when I was appreciating her poise that my attitude about the proceedings changed. I no longer felt the need to be up there where I was accustomed to be. I was no longer uncomfortable being down in the pews. At that moment, I was thankful to Lee Ellen for being at the helm, because I knew that in these proceedings, I would not want to have that responsibility. I was glad to be sitting in the pews yesterday. It was a lovely day, and the sun came pouring through the windows of the chapel. A couple of rows in front of me sat a line of students, a group of young women who, until 2 weeks ago, had been Hugh's advisees. As Hugh's son spoke, I shifted my weight a little to let the generous afternoon light bathe my face, and, letting go, I allowed myself the luxury of tears. A concerned friend recently asked me, "How do you grieve?" It was a good question. I had to give it some thought. Perhaps because Hugh was not part of my church, I was free to feel the great pain that his death inflicted upon me. I have no convenient professional compartment within which to place his death and understand it. Ministers are acquainted with grief, to be sure, but ours is meant to be a professional relationship. The minister's job is to channel or perhaps curate grief. We provide grief with a ritualized setting where the community can encounter it graciously and preferably without too much hullabaloo. As such, our role does not allow us to be subject to grief in the same way as everyone else. Sure, we can be appropriately somber, but when it comes to grief itself, I think we are expected to keep it at bay as we would an abstract notion or a particularly well-trained dog. So, how does a minister grieve? The question recalls the other famous vocational conundrums. How does a bus driver go on vacation? Or how does a shoemaker's children shod his children? Well, we know that the bus driver's holiday involves rental cars, and that shoemaker's children go barefoot. And I suppose you have guessed now that the minister, at least this one, grieves by writing a sermon about grief. Which is all very well, except that the sermon does not exist solely for the emotional well-being of the minister. To succeed, it must have relevance for the spiritual life of the community. And it wouldn't hurt to bring our mutual friend Jesus into the proceedings. Jesus, who in this morning's passage from the Gospel of Luke, has begun to make a name for himself teaching in the synagogues of Galilee. The scene set before us today describes a fraught moment in a Nazarene synagogue when Jesus reads from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and in the hearing of all, proclaims himself the fulfillment of the prophecy therein. If you keep reading beyond the lectionary passage where the passage ends, it quickly becomes clear that this rather audacious stunt doesn't go over well in Nazareth, and Jesus has to basically hightail it out of town in fear of his life. But that story is one for another day. Today, I would like to draw your attention to two things: the prophecy itself and Christ's claim of it. Anyone who has ever listened to Handel's Messiah or gone to the lessons and carols of Christmas Eve service knows that the book of Isaiah is filled with passages that Christians have claimed as prophecies of Christ. And of all the passages that suggest the appearance of the Messiah, observe the one that Jesus chooses himself to read. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. This is the prophecy that Jesus claims. He unrolls the scroll of Isaiah, and this is the claim he claims for himself. He reads this job description, points to it, and says, "That is me. I am that." Jesus knows who he is. He recognizes himself. He claims his identity in no uncertain terms before the assembly. And it is from this position of self-knowledge that he sets forth on his Galilean ministry. And what is at the core of this prophecy that Christ claims for himself? He claims that he is the one who brings good news to the poor, the one who proclaims the release of the captives. He is the one who will give sight to the blind and bring freedom to the oppressed. When Christ claims, "I am that," he describes relation. His I is not me. His I is we. Identity for Jesus cannot exist without relationship. To be, in a spiritual sense, is to move from I to we. I am. We are. The mystery of the divine character of Jesus has something to do with this. To be God is to conjugate the verb to be and to move from the singular to the plural. God is relational. When Christ says, "I am," he says, "We are." Hugh Silbo famously described his relationship to teaching in this way. He said that teaching for him began as an act of rebellion, grew into an act of love, and ultimately became an act of faith. I could see the love part manifestly, and you can see it too in the quote that I have offered from his faculty profile. It is my great hope that each of you who is listening can recognize this teacher, the teacher who cannot sit still, for the love of the subject. The teacher who may have 16 students in the room but makes you feel like you are the only one there. The teacher who laughs, pauses, reads the text lovingly, and reaches through it right into you. Hugh was the consummate artist at teaching. When you were in his classroom, you felt safe, challenged, supported. You could speak because you knew you were being heard. The seeds of your imagination could grow because he had furrowed the ground, dug in the compost, and shown you the sublime beauty of the fertile ground. I am. We are. You know a great teacher when you enter her classroom. Her eye is not me. Her eye is we. His teaching does not exist without relation. And the more a teacher can lovingly lean into the we of his identity, the more everyone learns, not only about the subject, but about being a compassionate human being. I learned yesterday that why Hugh said that teaching began as an act of rebellion. It was because Hugh was enrolled at Harvard Law School when he came to the realization that regardless of all the momentum of that trajectory, all the prestige and the promise of success, he did not see himself as a lawyer. That was not who he was. He was not a lawyer. I am. We are. He was a teacher. So he dropped out of Harvard. We are accustomed to getting into Harvard as the measure of success, but in Hugh's life, dropping out of Harvard was the crucial, decisive moment, akin to Jesus being chased out of Nazareth. Hugh knew who he was, and that wasn't it. His I was not me. His I was we. I am. We are. This is an act of faith, my friends. The best teacher conjugates the verb to be with their very life, moving from the first person singular to the first person plural. I am. We are. This movement is a giving over entirely of the self into what is great and true about we. It is easy to think that we is a place of mob violence and ethical lapse, as we saw undoubtedly on January 6th. But we, as Jesus taught us, and as Hugh also embodied in his life, is the essential category of faith. We rebels against the imperious and cynical I of consumer culture. We is the paradigm shift to love. We is the teacher's act of faith, sown in the fertile hearts, hands, and minds of beautiful young people, making them, if it is even possible, even more beautiful. Thank you, Hugh. Goodbye. I am. We are. Amen.